Dozens of lorries have begun to enter Gaza with aid for Palestinians. A ceasefire agreement brokered by the US requires at least 600 such deliveries a day. Hundreds of thousands of people have been returning to neighbourhoods in the north of Gaza, finding their homes and the vast majority of the infrastructure devastated by 2 years of war. May Alawada from the charity Medical Aid for Palestine is in southern Gaza.
We fully know that we are returning literally to rubbles, from starting from zero again. Hundreds of thousands of patients who have been cut off from medication that they need. So it wouldn't change overnight. But we as humanitarians, we really can't wait to have the aid coming into the Strip. And so finally, we would be able to support people on the ground.
An exchange of hostages held by Hamas and Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails is due to take place tomorrow. Hamas is said to be insisting that at least two out of a list of seven high-profile prisoners must be released by Israel in exchange for the remaining hostages it's holding. An attempted coup appears to be taking place in Madagascar. The presidency has said that an illegal and forcible seizure of power is underway in the African island nation. An elite army unit, which yesterday joined anti-government protests, has released a statement saying it's taken control of the armed forces. The Education Secretary has insisted that the National Security Advisor Jonathan Powell was not involved in discussions about the substance or the evidence in the collapsed case against two men accused of spying for China. Charges against Christopher Cash and Christopher Berry, who both deny the allegations, were dropped by prosecutors in September, prompting criticism from ministers and MPs. Many travellers to Europe will see changes in border security from today with the launch of the EU's new digital entry and exit system. Passports will be scanned and fingerprints registered at the point of entry. The scheme is aimed at detecting illegal immigrants and those who overstay their visas. And the weather, a settled and dry day, sunshine developing in the afternoon in central and western areas, whilst the east, north and far south will be cloudier. Temperatures will reach 17 Celsius in London, 16 in Cardiff, 15 in Edinburgh and 14 in Belfast. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Dramatist and screenwriter Martin Sherman made his name around the world with his 1979 play, Bent, about the persecution of gays in Nazi Germany. It starred Ian McKellen in London and Richard Gere on Broadway. His films include Callas Forever, directed by Franco Zeffirelli, with Fanny Ardant as Maria Callas, and Mrs. Henderson Presents, starring Judi Dench, and telling the story of the Windmill Theatre and its provocative wartime shows. More recently, he's written a very touching memoir, On the Boardwalk, which begins with his early years in New Jersey. Martin, music today from Rachmaninoff, Courtval, Chopin, but we're beginning with Bizet and Carmen, with Maria Callas.
Well, Carmen has so many, many, many meanings to me. For starters, it was a favorite song in my grandparents' household. My grandfather left the Ukraine as a young man, came to America, opened a fruit store. He was terribly poor. He brought over his wife and children. He ran the fruit store for a couple of years and then took to his bed. And he proceeded to die for the next 50 years. And his wife had to do everything and hold everything together. But during this long death, he would often come downstairs and on Saturday afternoons listen to the Metropolitan Opera. And he loved opera. And I don't know how. I don't know how he could have discovered it in the shtetl in the Ukraine. And the records of Carmen were strewn around the house. So Carmen had an early place in my existence. Then it popped up later, because I went to a theater department and there was a brilliant opera director who taught there named Sarah Caldwell. And the very first production that she did when I arrived was Carmen. So Carmen came back into my existence. And then many years later, I wrote a really bad film about Maria Callas that had scenes from Carmen. So it's a recurring theme.
It's a score that many musicians rate very, very highly. But it's awful to think that Bizet never realised how successful it was during his lifetime.
I know, I find that totally haunting. He had no idea.
Is a rebellious bird from Act One of Carmen by Bizet, performed by Maria Callas, and the Chorus and Orchestra of the Paris Opera, conducted by Georges Prêtre. I saw her in Tosca with Tito Gobbi in the 60s. That was pretty memorable. She was a wonderful actress as well as a fine singer.
Well, I used to study in New York at the Actors Studio of Lee Strasberg, who was the great method teacher. And he was once asked who was the greatest actress he ever saw on stage, and he said Maria Callas.
What drew you to her in terms of preparing the screenplay for Callas Forever?
Franco Zeffirelli. I had been working with him on something else, and he had an idea for a film, and I was intrigued, and I did it. The film has a brilliant central performance by Fanny Ardant, who's absolutely magnificent as Callas. And Jeremy Irons is wonderful in it as well. But unfortunately, the film, for many, many, many reasons, is not terribly good. But that happens.
Martin Sherman, we heard about your grandfather, but your grandmother, Bobby, was also an indomitable woman, wasn't she?
She was an indomitable woman and a very, very tough woman. She never exuded any warmth, at least not within my household. She may have had some kind of warmth towards her other children, but not towards my father. My father worshipped her. Never once did he utter a negative word about her. Now, children always say something bad about a parent, but not my father. And yet, she was always cold, 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 cold with him and with me because I was his child. I suspect it was because she was pregnant with my father when her husband left for America. She was alone in a little village in Ukraine. She had two other children. She had her husband's deaf sister to take care of as well. There was no money. It must have been absolute hell. And she probably hated the child in her womb. But she had to hold things together. And women in those days had unbelievable responsibilities sometimes. She took her children and her sister-in-law across Europe on wagons and somehow made it to America. I find the idea of that entire trip unbelievable now.
It's a film in itself, isn't it?
It's a film in itself. And I certainly don't understand financially how they did it, because it's not even that they were poor. They were peasants. That's beneath poor. But they did it. But, of course, one of the great problems of being a refugee is the trips you have to make as a refugee. The process of being a refugee does terrible things to your psyche and leaves terrible scars. And you very often don't recover from that journey. She and her children never recovered. They survived, and in many ways survived gloriously, but they didn't recover. They had such scars.
Your father was a very popular lawyer.
My father was an extraordinary man. He was an extremely popular lawyer. In Camden, New Jersey, which is in South Jersey, it was a very poor town, and his clients were very poor. He only handled criminal and divorce. He was very dramatic. He would make amazing presentations to the jury. He would come in and he would take a piece of paper out of his hand and look at the paper, consult the paper. Nothing was written on the paper. It was all an act. He knew absolutely no law, none whatsoever. He failed the bar exam about four times and only passed because there was a branch of Rutgers University had opened in South Jersey. So they had to have a few lawyers that had graduated. So they finally let him pass his bar exam. He wasn't interested in law per se. He wasn't interested in facts. And that's important, which I'll get back to. And in fact, his most famous case, I asked the prosecutor, what case of my father do you most remember? And he said, oh, it's easy. We had this guy up for robbery. And we had every bit of evidence you could possibly wish for. We presented it to the jury. We had this guy cold. And then your father got up and said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what had the prosecution just presented to you? Facts. what good are facts? And he walked. He got the guy off. And it was partly because my father believed it. And the reason he believed it was he was informally diagnosed by a member of my family who was a therapist. He was informally diagnosed as having a narcissistic complex, which is the same informal diagnosis that Donald Trump has received. My father hated facts. He would be very dramatic in front of a jury and he would say, look at that poor boy. The Bible says thou shalt not harm the head of the child. That, and he would quote something from the Bible, which was a book he never read. He made everything up. Workers in the city hall used to leave their position, leave their job, when they knew my father was talking in front of a jury because it was such a great show.
You were something of a miracle baby yourself.
Yeah. My parents had tried for a very long time to have a child, and it wasn't happening, and then finally it did, and my father always thought of it as a miracle. It's a very sensitive subject for me because, obviously, I'm delighted they had me. I'm thrilled to be here, but they should not have. And in a way, it was very wrong to have me because my mother had a terrible, and terrible is a mild word, hereditary disease called Huntington's disease. And there was a 50% chance that their child would inherit that. In those days, nothing was known about Huntington's at all, and no one cared. Because it wasn't public, because nobody famous had it, there was no money in it. And therefore, doctors paid no attention to it. So you were on your own, pretty much, if you had it. And it was a debilitating neurological disease. Those words are so inadequate. It was just a nightmare. It was absolutely terrible.
Well, we're very glad you're here.
but I am very glad I'm here, too.
You went to the cinema quite a bit as an early age.
I went to the cinema and I went to the theater. There was one song in the film I loved because it was about Atlantic City. And Atlantic City was like a second home to me. We went there every summer. And so the film was a grade B film that was a remake of another grade B film. They remade the same films all the time in Hollywood. A studio owned a story, and they would remake it and remake it and remake it. And this film was called Three Little Girls in Blue. And the song on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, which is a silly, flimsy, old-fashioned 40s song, but was my fantasy of what I was living every summer in Atlantic City.
Goodbye, little chicks, we are leaving the sticks. We are catching the train at a quarter to six. And if anyone should drop around, won't you please tell them that we can be found on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. We will walk in a dream. On the boardwalk in Atlantic City, life will be peaches and cream. There, where the saltwater air brings out a lady's charm. There, on a rolling chair, he'll roll right into your arms. Cinderella, you will find your fella, someone that you've waited for. In romantic, enchanted Atlantic City. The boardwalk in Atlantic City. We will walk in a dream. On the boardwalk in Atlantic City, life will be peaches and cream. There, where the saltwater air brings out a lady's charms. There, on a rolling chair, we'll roll right into your arms. Cinderella, you will find your fella. That you waited for.
$9.25 per day.
That is expensive.
Well, I guess if we want to live in a place like this, we have to pay for it.
That's right, Liz. But please, let's not worry about it. Listen to that music. Isn't it wonderful? Promise me you won't worry about anything. Promise. Cross your heart. Atlantic City. Oh, come on, Myra. What's money? At last we're living.
On the shore, life is gay.
Well, it should be at 9 1/4 a day.
On the boardwalk in Atlantic City, we will walk in a dream. On the boardwalk in Atlantic City, life will be peaches and cream. There, where the saltwater air brings out a lady's charm.
Fella, someone like you've waited for.
In romantic, enchanting Atlantic City, down on the old New Jersey shore.
What I love about that song is its almost obscene naivete and innocence. Those were terrible times. People were very, very, very unhappy. But that's what we saw in the films.
Escapism.
That kind of escapism, yeah.
On the Boardwalk in Atlantic City from the film Three Little Girls in Blue, composed by Joseph Miro, with lyrics by Mac Gordon and sung by June Haver, Vivian Blaine and Vera Ellen. Do you recall your visits to Atlantic City with as much pleasure as I could see that song was giving you then, Martin Sherman?
Yes, I do. It was the only bright spot in my childhood. My aunt and uncle owned a hotel called the Pierpont, a Jewish kosher hotel. And my uncle was a fearsome man with a false eye who had been a composer in the Yiddish theater. My aunt was very grand and I think very ahead of her time. She was quite feminist. And my grandmother ran the kitchen. It was filled with amazing characters and color and music and melancholy and a yearning for the old country.
One of the positive things from your point of view, I imagine, about your mum was that she loved to swim.
Yes, that's also a mixed bag. She loved to swim. And it was the one thing that she had that was rather her own. So she would swim quite far out when we were in Atlantic City. The reason I say it's a mixed bag is that she wouldn't teach me, and I never learned to swim. And it's very difficult to talk about my mother because I don't really know who she was. I'm not absolutely sure why I don't know who she was, because she was a loving woman, I think. And when I was very young, I think we had a real relationship. And yet I don't remember anything that she ever said to me. And I don't think she was able to make a real connection with me. I'm sure it had to do because of her illness, which is a progressive illness. And when I was very, very young, she wasn't quite showing signs of it. But her father had it, her brother had it. And she knew that she was going to get it, but she didn't know what it was exactly. The lack of knowledge about it was primitive and scary, so life must have been hell for her, absolute hell.
Well, Huntington's does affect not only movement, but also thinking and mood, so it's quite possible that she was locked in her own world to a certain extent.
Yes, it's very possible that she was locked in her own world. It's very hard to know. They still know relatively little about it, although they have isolated the gene. There's now a test that you can have that tells you whether you're going to get it or not. That didn't exist in my day.
So you've escaped it then?
I escaped it, but I didn't know I escaped it until I escaped it. In other words, it was only when I turned 40 that it began to dawn on me that I wasn't getting it. Until then, there was a large possibility that I would. And I didn't think about it every day at all. But of course, it was there in my subconscious. And it was there in the way that people treated me in my family. They thought that I probably would have a damaged and cut off life.
Rachmaninoff next.
Well, I was born in the radio, and television came in when I was about, I guess, 9 or 10. There was a local program in Philadelphia that showed old movies. It made me fall in love with old films, and in a way, fall in love with the idea of film and the history of film. And this program was introduced, the theme song was Rachmaninoff, the Rhapsody on the Theme of Paganini. So each week I heard this lush, romantic music, and it was melodically a wonderful part of my childhood. And there were a couple other programs that also had Russian theme songs. So this was a period when you weren't allowed to say anything about Russia, when you were investigated if you had any ties to Russia. But on television, the themes of a lot of shows were great Russian symphonic pieces.
Well, let's hear the variations 17 and 18 of the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, which, of course, will include, when we get there, that wonderful melody. Yeah.
Thank you.
I wonder whether you feel that you are a romantic, having heard the variations 17 and 18 of the Rhapsody on the Theme of Paganini by Rachmaninoff, which I should say was performed by Stephen Hough, and the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Litton. Do you respond to the romanticism in that music?
Oh, yeah. If I hadn't been a romantic, I wouldn't have responded to it. It would have just been music on in the background of a television show. Yeah. Absolutely. Not just a romanticism, there's also a melancholy.
Well, that's part of romanticism.
I suppose it is, yes.
Especially in the Russian literature.
Especially
and music.
In Russian. Yeah, and I am Russian. And it's very interesting that when we talked earlier, I said that my family were from the Ukraine. I was being politically correct. They never, ever, ever mentioned the word Ukraine. It was always Russia. They were always from Russia. It was only many years later that I realized it was actually Ukraine.
Now, your mother didn't teach you to swim, but your aunt taught the piano. So did she teach you how to play?
She tried. It was a huge failure. And it was my fault. I couldn't accept my beloved aunt as a teacher. It was a different role. I didn't want to have her in that role. Also, my brain, I could learn to read the right side of the music. I could not ever read the left side. I couldn't join both hands.
Even though your mother was clearly a difficult person to get to know, she did introduce you to the theatre.
She introduced me to the theatre, and I was 7 or 8 or something. And she took me to a couple plays, and a couple she shouldn't have been taking me to because they had adult material. I remember saying to my mother, "What's a mistress?" And then after about 1.5 years, she just stopped. And I'm sure it had something to do with the illness beginning to grow. But she stopped. But I didn't stop. I kept going. And so I would go every Saturday to Philadelphia and see a matinee. And I was not yet a teenager. Sometimes it would be very bizarre. It would be this little boy sitting in a theater surrounded by adults watching a Tennessee Williams play. And I saw everything on the way to New York, because Philadelphia was a tryout city. And I have vivid clinical memory of the plays I saw, of the staging, of the performances, whereas I can't remember anything I saw a week ago, let alone 10 years ago. But I remember everything I saw before I left the house in New Jersey.
Well, let me test you on that. 1951, I think. Which prompted your next choice?
Carmen Miranda?
Yeah.
Well, that's... I fell in love with Carmen Miranda on film. I suppose some people today would say, well, yes, of course, because she was a gay icon and she was camp. But that wasn't it. That wasn't it at all. Actually, she was extremely tiny. And to give herself height, she wore these enormous hats that were filled with fruit. But every so often she would take off the hat and you would see her entire face and you would see her hair. And the truth is, she looked like my mother. Freud would
have... I was going to say Freud would have a field day.
He would have had a field day. He would have had a field day. So I was madly in love with Carmen Miranda, and she came to Philadelphia to a nightclub, and my mother took me and we went backstage afterwards. She took my hand and she said she had always wanted a child and she couldn't have one, and how lucky my mother was. And then she kissed me. Carmen Miranda kissed me. And of course, the entire scene was filled with ironies and Chekhovian subtleties.
Well, that's a wonderful thought to have in our mind as we listen.
Oh, but before we hear that, I should tell you that years and years later, I went to Brazil for a production of Bent, and I was met by the producers at the airport, and they said, "Do you know any Portuguese?" I very proudly said, "Oh, yes, of course I do. I know Mamá y quero, da chapita, mamá," which was a song Carmen Miranda sang. They said, "Do you know what that means?" I said, "No, absolutely not." Because one of the interesting things about Carmen Miranda's great success in America is that no one ever understood a word of what she was singing. So I said, "No, I don't." They said, "It means I suckle up my mother's breast." So that's what I was listening to all the time. That was my favorite Carmen Miranda song. So Freud would also very much enjoy that. But all of America was reveling to that song, not knowing what it was.
Mama, 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 you care. Mama, you care. Eu quero, mamá, da chupeta, da chupeta pro bebê não chorar.
Mamã, 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 eu quero, mamã, eu quero, mamã, eu quero, mamá, ai, da chupeta, ai, da chupeta, da chupeta pro bebê não chorar. Dorme, filhinho do meu coração, pega a mamadeira e vem entrar no meu cordão. Eu tenho uma irmã que se chama Ana, de piscar o olho já ficou sem a pestana. Mamã, mamã, mamãe, eu quero.
Mamã,
mamã, eu quero.
Mamã,
mamã, eu quero, mamã. Ai, dá chupeta, ai, dá chupeta. Dá chupeta pro bebê não chorar.
Mamã, 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 mamãe, eu quero.
Mamã,
mamã, eu quero.
Mamã,
mamãe, eu quero, mamã. Dá chupeta, dá chupeta. Dá chupeta pro bebê não chorar.
Eu olho as pequenas, mas daquele jeito, e tenho muita pena não ser criança de peito. Eu tenho uma irmã que é fenomenal, ela é da bossa e o marido é um boçal. Mamã, 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 eu quero.
Mamã,
mamã, eu quero.
Mamã,
mamã, eu quero, mamã. Ai, dá chupeta, ai, dá chupeta. Dá chupeta pro bebê não chorar.
Mamã, 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 eu quero.
Mamã,
mamã, eu quero.
Mamã,
mamãe, eu quero, mamã. Dá chupeta, dá chupeta, dá chupeta pro bebê não chorar. Mamãe, eu quero.
Mamãe,
eu quero.
Very proud to have introduced Carmen Miranda to Private Passions.
I think, Martin Sherman, since you've given us such a good explanation of the meaning of the song, that I will omit some of the references and simply call it I Want My Mama from Carmen Miranda. You wanted, Martin, to become an actor yourself and went for elocution lessons.
Oh, yeah. There was a teacher in Philadelphia called Mae Desmond, who was an old-time actress, very dramatic. And I went for elocution lessons. I had to go because I couldn't say my THs. I don't even know if I'm saying them correctly now, but she made me say Theophilus Thistle thrust 3,000 thistles through the thick of his thumb. And then she gave me some speeches to learn. So I probably was about 11, and I was walking around reciting King Lear's final speech. When he's carrying Cordelia. I find that in retrospect so bizarre. I can't believe I was doing that. And then she had a children's theater and she put me in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
But you were very tall and thin.
I was very tall, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, you were quite aware of your physical appearance at that point.
Yeah, it was ghastly. When I was about 13 or 14, clinically, I can't exactly say what it was, but I would imagine it was some form of malnutrition, partly because I wasn't getting proper food. My mother wasn't able to cook properly anymore, and my father tried, but he didn't really know how. I was incredibly thin. When I was 21, I think I weighed about 106 pounds, which I think is something like 7.5 stone. It was dangerously thin. And I had really bad skin. Oh, and I had a humongous overbite. Physically, I was an absolute mess.
You applied to Boston University.
they had a theatre school, but they didn't have a criteria. they didn't audition you. I was admitted along with a group of other misfits, some of whom really should not have been there, and some of whom were startlingly brilliant.
In fact, it was on the way there, I think, when your father drove you, that you first found out about your mother's ill health.
Yes, I was the first person in the family to ever leave, and I was staying in a dormitory. And he deposited me in the room, and he told me. I didn't know what was happening to my mother. She was becoming more and more remote. She was dropping things. But when you grow up and live in a house, you think your house is normal. So I didn't know that something was wrong. I felt something was wrong. I must have, but I was in many ways incredibly bright. And I was also, in other ways, incredibly stupid. And this is one of the ways. So when we arrived in Boston, my father sat me down and told me that my mother had a hereditary incurable disease that I may very well might have myself. Thank you. Enjoy your life in Boston.
Devastating.
Devastating. Which basically meant that certainly for my first year in Boston, and maybe even beyond that, I was in shock.
You talked about how you saw those films on television. And of course, Leonard Bernstein was somebody who brought music to a huge audience later through his television programs. But it's Bernstein's music we're going to hear next.
Yeah. In my second year of college, before I left for Boston that year, the night before in Philadelphia, I went to the opening night of West Side Story, which was on its way to New York. It was the first performance, I think. So he had a very strong position in my theatrical sensibility. And what I love about the overture to Candide is it jumps genres because it was written for the theater. But actually now it just may be his most successful piece of classical music. And I love it when things are able to visit different disciplines.
Thank you. wonderful sense of naughtiness.
Oh, so nice.
Lenny Bernstein's Overture to Candide, performed by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra and conducted by the composer. It's fair to say, I think, Martin, that acting wasn't actually where your talents lay.
No, I was terrible. Well, you know why? Because you have to be able to be comfortable with yourself, comfortable with your body, comfortable with your being. I was comfortable with nothing. So there was no way then that I could be a good actor. And it would have been years until I had a sense of myself. So it had to be something else.
You found you could write sketches.
Yeah. Well, I actually started writing plays when I was about 11. And then when I was in Boston, I started writing review sketches.
Was it at Boston that you first came to terms with being gay yourself?
I suppose it's the first time it took the form of real words and meaning to me, yeah. Because I fell in love with somebody and it was real. Prior to that, I can't begin to describe the kind of haze that I lived in. I don't even remember having puberty. I think I was cut off from everything. So it's not only that I realized I was gay in Boston, but I realized that I had some other aspect of my life.
One of your fellow actors who did shine at Boston was Olympia Dukakis, and she would later star in your play Rose.
Yes.
At the National Theatre in 1999. Rose was a one-woman play about an 80-year-old Ukrainian Jew looking back at the joys and horrors of her lifetime. And I imagine you must have been drawing on your family's experience.
It was totally drawn on my family's experience, but everything was mixed together and mixed in, and then I added things, of course. And Olympia did it originally, and then recently Maureen Lipman did it here again.
I think also at Boston University, it is fascinating how one's colleagues at that time of one's life are so influential. But I think Joan Byers was there too.
I was a senior, and Joan Byers was a freshman, briefly. She was there for about 2 or 3 months. And I used to sit with my fellow seniors at a table, and we would watch another table with the freshmen, and this girl with long black hair would be playing a guitar and singing, and they were all sort of at her feet listening. And we were all extraordinarily snobbish. And we said, "Ugh, look at them. Isn't that just so typical? Just a typical folk singer. Oh, what a joke. Ha ha." And, you know, within about 5 or 6 years, I was fighting with people to get tickets for a Joan Baez concert because I worshipped her. But I never went over to that table. I missed it.
Now, we're going to hear her in a piece by Villa-Lobos, which is one of the Bachianas Brasileiras.
It's not a piece of crossover, somebody from one discipline performing another. And people were very surprised that she actually did this.
It's a rather a wonderful melody, of course.
Oh, it's a gorgeous melody. And she had exquisite taste. Something that usually isn't mentioned when people talk about Joan Baez, but if you went to her concerts in the 60s and 70s, she was incredibly funny. She had the most wonderful, real sense of humour.
Thank you.
That was an extraordinary thing to hear, Joan Baez singing like that. Joan Baez and David Sawyer were playing the cello in music from the Bacchianas Brasileiras by Villa-Lobos. It was conducted by Maurice Abravanel. Martin Sherman, what is your approach to writing for the stage?
You have to love the solitude of the actual writing, and you have to also love the communal feeling of putting it onto a stage.
You wrote your first play, A Solitary Thing, in 1963, but it was a number of years before you became a successful playwright. Were you ever tempted to give up, or did you just know you had to persevere and you'd get there one day?
Well, the problem was I didn't know how to do anything else. I don't know what I would have done if I thought there was something that I could do halfway decently, because the temptation to give up was enormous, and yet I had no choice. I really had no choice. And I only realize this now. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was functioning and people around me were functioning under the belief that I may only have a few years. So I think I was indulged.
The following year after that play, 1964, you saw the Civil Rights March in Washington. Did that make a profound impression on you?
Well, America was in turmoil then. It was a different kind of turmoil than now, because there was hope. And there was hope that you could change things. So I was involved with the Civil Rights Movement, as was almost anybody my age. And I had a number of experiences as a young man that I call my Zelig experiences, in which I ended up places that I should not have been and was a party to events that I really didn't belong at, but were historic events. So I went on the march to Washington, which was the big civil rights march of the day, with a group of actors in a bus that was very slow. So we were the last bus to enter Washington. We were as far behind because a huge crowd. The stage was way ahead of us. And then suddenly, while the ceremony was going on, a group of policemen came. And there was an actress called Madeline Sherwood, and she was in the middle of the policemen. And she looked and she saw me and a couple of the actors that I was with. We were all very young. We were about 21, 22. She said, them, there. And the policeman took us and said, follow us. And we didn't know where we were going. And suddenly we were walking up steps and we realized we were on the Lincoln Memorial with hundreds of thousands of people in front of us. And as we stood at the back of the Lincoln Memorial, Martin Luther King walked in front of us to the microphone and said, I had a dream, and gave that great speech. The reason we were there was they were looking for people who had been on the bus to represent actors. And we were just unemployed kids, but we ended up on, I was on the platform when Martin Luther King made the most historic speech.
Amazing. You drove across America, Martin, and you spent some time in New Orleans, which musically must have been very inspirational.
Well, the cliche was true. You would hear music on every street corner. And I found it the most beautiful and moving and inspiring city in America. And I had a strange relationship with the city. We seemed to know each other. But I used to listen to jazz at Preservation Hall, which was an old building, and they had gotten together a jazz band of old jazz players in their 70s and 80s. So this was in the early 60s, which meant they were young at the birth of jazz. So they were literally originals. There was a kind of anarchy, and it was very freewheeling, and it wasn't commercialized slick. It was, in the best sense of the word, real.
Thank you.
Well, I have an even greater appreciation of that cut now because they're all the age I am now.
St. James Infirmary, performed by the wonderful Preservation Hall Jazz Band, with vocals by Billy Pearce, arranged by Dewey Redman, and recorded in April of 1966. Martin Sherman, you ended up living in London and worked with the founding members of the Gay Sweatshop. Tell us what that was and why it was important.
Well, the Gay Sweatshop was founded in 1975 here in London by a group of young radical gay artists who were very unhappy with the way gay people were portrayed in theatre. And they wanted to be able to present plays that they thought told the truth about gay life by gay writers. And so they had a season at a little fringe theatre called The Almost Free. And I had written a play called Passing By, which involved a romance between two men. It was unusual for its day, I imagine, because there weren't plays about gay men who were simply people, in which their gayness was not an overwhelming problem or a tragedy. And this play had been produced at a small theater in New York with the best intentions in the world, and it was just ghastly. It was done very badly, and in part because there was no tradition of doing a play like that. And it was very hard to get actors who would agree to perform a play like that. And I was extremely disheartened. But it was picked up by the Gay Sweatshop here, and I came over for the production. And it was the first good production I ever had in my life. It kept me sane and renewed my love of writing for the theatre. It saved my life. This very simply saved my life and led ultimately to my writing bent.
Yes, because there was an image in a play as time goes by which struck you very forcibly.
I saw a rehearsal of a play that they were doing a few years later called As Time Goes By, and there was a suitcase with a pink triangle on it, and I was immediately struck by that, and I wanted to know the history of that. You had to wear an insignia according to what you were. Jews wore famous yellow stars. Political prisoners wore red. If you were gay, you wore a pink triangle if you were in a camp. And when I say gay, I mean specifically a gay man, because the Nazis did not recognize that such a thing as lesbianism existed. And when I discovered the history, which was what happened to gay men in Nazi Germany, I immediately wanted to write a play about it. And I did. I gave it to Drew Griffiths, who was the head of the Gay Sweatshop and a visionary man. He said, "Oh, no, we can't do this." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, no, you have, which is small. You have to, this has to go out into the world. You have to go beyond us," which is the most generous thing anyone has ever done professionally for me in my life.
Bent was about the way in which Nazis treated homosexuals, and I believe an intimidating librarian in London was quite helpful for research.
Yeah, I asked her, the Wiener Library, which has every book ever printed about Nazi Germany, and there was hardly anything written about the treatment of homosexuals in Nazi Germany. So I said, "Do you have anything about homosexuals in Nazi Germany?" She said, "You mean the Nazis as homosexuals?" I said, no. I mean the way they treated homosexuals. Well, she clearly didn't like the idea, but she was a wonderful librarian. And so she would find a book and show me a paragraph that had a sentence or two, and I began to gather material, and I began to find things.
The premiere was at the Royal Court in London with Ian McKellen and Tom Bell in the leading roles. The dialogue was, for its time, very graphic. Was there anxiety about staging?
Oh, God, was there anxiety? Oh, please. The artistic director of the Royal Court used to phone me every day and say, "Are you sure you really want to do this? Can you really say this?" The Royal Court absolutely did not want to do the play, but They had no money. They were in a huge financial crisis. And Eddie Kulikunas, who was a visionary West End producer, had taken the rights to the play. And the court couldn't turn down his money and the presence of Ian. So they had to do the play, but they were frightened of it and they didn't understand it. The sex scene scared the hell out of them.
Ian was a well-known classical actor at that point.
Yes.
Was he at all worried about doing it?
Yes, he was nervous about doing it. And when he received it for the first time, he read it and didn't know what to do. And his partner at the time was a young actor named Sean Mathias. And he gave it to Sean and said, read this, and what do you think? Sean read it and said, you have to do this. You absolutely have to do this play. And, of course, that took on great repercussions later, because the first revival of the play 10 years later at the National was directed by Sean. And the film was directed by Sean. But, of course, once Ian committed to it, he committed to it completely and wholeheartedly and bravely. I don't think his bravery in doing that play is fully appreciated. For an actor of his stature, known for classical work, to do such an openly gay play was a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous act.
Well, he's been at the forefront of gay rights. Really,
yes, but this was before he came out. Mm. I can't emphasize how brave it was.
A Kurt Weill song next, Martin, by a prominent composer during the Weimar Republic era in Germany. And, of course, this was also another sort of revolt that was going on.
Oh, yes, and Benda seeped in the spirit of the Weimar Republic, the first part of the play, certainly, by the fact that you could have very creative forces and an enormous sense of freedom, sexual freedom and artistic freedom, bubbling away and inspiring great work, and then clamp. It can all be cut down in a second. That was the Weimar Republic. It meant a lot in the creation of Ben, and it's a very scary thing to think about today.
This is a wonderful song, sung by Lottie Lenya and with words by Bertolt Brecht.
And this recording is an original recording from 1930, when you get a sense of the chaos of the time, because there are later recordings that are wonderful, but they're very disciplined.
This has got the rough edge.
Oh, show us the way to the next whiskey bar.
Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why.
For we must find the next whiskey bar. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar,
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die.
Oh, moon of Alabama, we now must say goodbye. So good old mama,
The extraordinary thing about that song, Martin, is it starts with that oompa, oompa, but then there's that wonderfully lyrical tune.
Yes.
You know, it could have been the Paganini Rachmaninoff.
Yes,
couldn't it?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Alabama Song, written by Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill, and performed by Lottie Lenier with the Three Admirals Ensemble, the orchestra of Kurfürsten, conducted by Hans Sommer. The first night of Bent was also the night Margaret Thatcher was first elected Prime Minister. That's
yeah, I thought history got it wrong in terms of the importance.
How did it go down, the play?
The audience response was overwhelming, thrilling. Critically, there were some really, really nice reviews and some terrible ones. The terrible ones literally said that I couldn't write. They were incensed by it. Some of them were written by closeted gay men.
It moved to the West End, yes, and eventually Broadway, where a star-studded audience, including Paul Simon, Diana Ross, Shirley MacLaine, came to see it on opening night. Did you feel vindicated by now?
Yeah, well, I probably was in a state of blissful shock during most of it because it had taken so long for me to have any kind of success. I was 40 or 41 by that time. But also, it was never easy on Broadway. We had a producer who had a love-hate relationship with the play and was threatening to close it every day during previews. So we never knew if it was actually going to open. It wasn't possible to relax and just enjoy what was happening.
You had a particular book in your pocket that night.
Yes, it was a book of the complete works of Shakespeare that my mother gave me when I was a child. Again, she never said anything to me about it. I don't have any memory of her presenting it to me and saying, this means a lot to me, this is a... But she did give it to me, and I did have it, and I took it with me when I went to the opening.
And the other thing that must have been rather wonderful about that period, you said you were in your early 40s, was you must have been beginning to realise that you perhaps were free of Huntington's.
Yes, it coincided with that realisation, and it started a new life for me, literally.
What led you to this Chopin that we're going to hear next, played by Maurizio?
Well, some years later, I wrote a play about Isadora Duncan, which Vanessa Redgrave performed in the West End when she danced. And one of the numbers she danced to was a Chopin etude. And in the play, she rehearses to it, and her rehearsal consists of simply listening to the song, sitting on the stage, still, not moving, and listening to the song. And Michael Sheen, in his first performance, played the pianist. It's just the most gorgeous Chopin. And representative of, I suppose, some of the work that I was doing after Bent.
extraordinarily powerful for just 2 minutes of music.
I know. It's like a lifetime in those 2 minutes.
The Etude No. 9 in F minor by Chopin, wonderfully performed by Maurizio Pollini. Martin Sherman, you've written a number of very successful screenplays, including Mrs. Henderson Presents, which starred Judi Dench. After being such a fan of film, you must really have enjoyed the experience of screenwriting.
Yes, I love writing for films, because, as well as for the theatre, they're completely different. It's the differences that make it so enjoyable.
You also wrote a revised version of the musical The Boy from Oz about the flamboyant Australian singer-songwriter and entertainer Peter Allen, played by Hugh Jackman, which won a Tony Award. Was it easy to fashion a musical out of pre-existing songs?
It was complicated. In some ways, I suppose, easier, and in some ways, much, much more difficult. What was difficult was that I had to make the scene really specifically sound as though it was leading into the lyric of the song. So you had to have the feeling that the song had been written for that scene and for that musical, when, of course, it hadn't been at all.
And did you find Hugh Jackman a good collaborator?
Wonderful collaborator, and the most joyous man at the theatre. I mean, it was the male musical performance of its time, I would say, because most great musicals have a phenomenal role for a woman. It's unusual to find that kind of role for a man. And boy, did he run with it. He was extraordinary.
We've sadly come to the end of the programme, so I have to ask you what your final piece of music is going to be, Martin.
Well, it has to be Mabel Mercer. It has to be. Because Mabel Mercer solidified my love of songs, my love of lyrics, my love of life, I would say. I was introduced to her music when I was about 19. I was appalled when I first heard her. I thought, what a terrible voice, and who wants to listen to this? But I was told to persevere, and I did. And she's an acquired taste. Once acquired, you're an infinitely richer human being. All she would do, she would sit on a chair in a small club, and her hands would be folded in front of her, and she would sing. And she made sense of a lyric in a way that no one else, I think, ever did. And people like Frank Sinatra and Billie Holiday used to go and study her, learn from her phrasing. And she took songs from musicals that had been forgotten, and she resurrected them, and then they would be recorded by others. But also, a lot of songwriters wrote songs just for her. They were cabaret songs. They were melancholy. They were usually disguised gay songs, usually bittersweet. The song we're going to hear was written by someone who is not really listed as having written anything else. And then when she would sing the song, other singers would pick them up and record them. And their recordings often became quite famous. But she suggested an urban world, a world of sophistication, a world of minor heartbreak that certainly appealed to me when I was 19. She was one of a kind.
Well, we've come to the end of the programme, and we're going to hear The End of the Love Affair
yes.
by Mabel Mercer. So it only remains for me to thank you very much indeed, Martin Sherman.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Dear Dorothy Dix, I'm in an awful fix. I thought he was in love with me, but find that he is only up to his old tricks. Dear Emily Post, no wiser I than most, please exercise your nimble brain and tell me how a girl can entertain a ghost. So I'm writing to you for advice, ladies. The situation isn't very nice, ladies. I find myself completely at a loss, ladies. My heart, not my mind, is boss. So I walk a little too fast, and I drive a little too fast, and I'm reckless, it's true. But what else can you do at the end of a love affair? So I talk a little too much, and I laugh a little too much, and my voice is too loud when I'm out in a crowd, so that people are apt to stare. Do they know, do they care that it's only that I'm lonely and low as can be? And the smile on my face isn't really a smile at all. So I smoke a little too much, and I drink a little too much, and the tunes I request are not always the best, but the ones where the trumpets blare. And I go at a maddening pace, and I pretend that it's taking his place. But what else can you do at the end of a love affair? Do they know, do they care that it's only that I'm lonely and low as can be? And the smile on my face isn't really a smile at all. So I smoke a little too much, and I drink a little too much, and the tunes I request are not always the best, but the ones where the trumpets blare. And I go at a maddening pace, and I pretend that it's taking his place. But what else can you do at the end of a love affair?
The End of the Love Affair by Mabel Mercer, composed by Edward Redding. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the dramatist and screenwriter Martin Sherman. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week's guest will be the poet Holly McNish. And next on Radio 3, Sarah Moore Peach goes on a musical journey to Peter Warlock's Capriole Suite.
You'll recognise his music. But how much do you actually know about the man himself? Johann Sebastian Bach, the poster boy for serious music, a towering cultural icon, but also a rule breaker. We'll follow him as he makes his way from courts to coffee houses, building a family, two-timing his bosses, and even spending a stint behind bars. Composer of the Week, Johann Sebastian Bach. Starts tomorrow afternoon from 4 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Stay with us this afternoon on Radio 3. Alan Shipton brings us jazz record requests at 4. And before that, Choral Evensong comes from Bolton Lemoore's. Now on Radio 3, though, it's time for this week's edition of Music Map with Sarah Moore Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. Today's journey will guide our ears towards a 20th century composer looking into the distant past. This is Peter Warlock's Capriole Suite from 1926, which we'll hear in full at the end of today's show. It takes a set of ancient dances, which we'll hear more about later, and refashions them for the modern orchestra, which is rather what Norwegian composer Edvard Grieg did in his Holberg Suite.